Today at Reader's Corner, Michael Graybell, author of Money Well Spent, The Truth Behind the $1 Million Stimulus, the biggest economic recovery plan in history.
You know, everyone thinks about the New Deal and the Works Progress Administration. Well, adjusting for inflation, the Recovery Act was 5 times bigger than the WPA. It pumped $800 billion into the economy, but almost 3/4 of it was invisible to the public. With the stimulus having been designed the way it was and creating such animosity, the partisan politics has become so stagnant that none of these extensions that need to happen are likely to take place in the next 5 to 10 years.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, passed by Congress in 2009, was the largest economic recovery plan in U.S. history. The stimulus plan pumped billions of dollars into the economy at a time when the country was reeling from the impacts of the Great Recession, with deep unemployment, a collapsed housing market, and a growing concern about the future of the U.S. economy in a shifting global marketplace. The Recovery Act has been criticized for approving questionable projects and for massive inefficiencies, and praised for creating new jobs and funding real improvements. Today's guest, investigative reporter Michael Graybell, tackles the complex issues surrounding this landmark legislation in a new book, Money Well Spent, The Truth Behind the $1 Trillion Stimulus, the biggest economic recovery plan in history. To research his book, Mr. Graybell followed the progress of stimulus projects across the country, examining how reality and spin collided and how good intentions were often wrecked on the rocky shores of bad politics. Mr. Graybell has been a reporter at the independent nonprofit ProPublica since 2008, producing stories for USA Today, NPR, the CBS Evening News, and Salon Magazine. Before joining ProPublica, he was a reporter at the Dallas Morning News. Mr. Graybell joins us by phone for this interview. Michael Graybell, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Could you help us with placing some perspective on this issue, the size of this stimulus compared to what in American history?
Sure. So the amount of money spent on the stimulus bill was $831 billion. And if you adjust for inflation, that's actually bigger than the moon race, bigger than the Manhattan Project, bigger than the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe after World War II. And, you know, everyone thinks about the New Deal and the Works Progress Administration. Well, based on, you know, adjusting for inflation, the Recovery Act was 5 times bigger than the WPA.
So what is the cost of the stimulus compared to something like the Iraq War?
The stimulus package was more expensive than it took to fight the Iraq War from 2003 to 2010, the first 7 years.
And what did the stimulus package include? Help us by breaking it down in terms of the two or three categories that drove this entire mission.
The bill contained about $300 billion in tax cuts. Then there was about $200 billion in safety net spending. This is things like Medicaid, unemployment benefits, food stamps. About $100 billion was spent on education, both to save teacher jobs. States were facing these severe budget cuts, as many of them still are, and also to promote some education reforms. And then there was about $200 billion that was set aside for infrastructure-type projects. And this was a mix of, you know, the products that we heard were going to be shovel-ready and some long-term investments in things like clean energy, broadband, electronic health records, electric cars, and high-speed rail.
And one of the things I think you point out in the book is that so much of this stimulus package, or a considerable part of it, was invisible. I assume you meant those first two categories as opposed to the third category. I mean, if in fact they were shovel-ready, at least it would have been something, and it was something that people could eventually see. We'll get to some of the improvements that were made as a result of the stimulus. But is that what you mean by invisible, the tax cuts and the Medicaid assistance and things like that?
Yes, exactly. I mean, they pumped $800 billion into the economy, but almost 3/4 of it was invisible to the public. People might not remember this, but everyone received about $10 more in their paycheck every week through a middle-class tax cut. And this was done by the administration to do it differently from the way President Bush had done it, where people in the spring of 2001 and the spring of 2008 received several hundred dollar check in the mail. And so this was done as a way to encourage people to spend, but still it was a very small amount that most people didn't notice it and it didn't really affect the way that they spent their money. And the second thing was safety net spending and this education spending was largely keeping things as a status quo. If you spend more at the grocery store or at the health clinic because you have Medicaid, you know, instead of having no health insurance, you're creating jobs for maybe a health clinic worker or a nurse or a supermarket cashier, but you're not going to notice that that's a stimulus job because it takes many steps along the way to do that. And the same went for the teachers where, you know, if it was saving a teacher's job, people didn't notice that because that's a teacher that's always been in my kid's classroom. It wasn't like a new teacher was brought in or anything changed.
One of the things you point out toward the end of your book, I mean, you're building up to it throughout the book, is that the program was poorly designed. And I'd like to focus for a minute, if we could, on just how this stimulus package came to being and then how it was implemented. The White House didn't write every section of this bill. Am I correct that they sort of handed it off to Speaker Pelosi and the Democratic majority, hoping that perhaps they'd get some support from the other side of the aisle? But the writing of the bill and all of the details of the bill were mostly left to Congress. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And this was the process started when President Obama hadn't been inaugurated yet. It was still the transition team. And they had several meetings talking about like what kind of programs might work. And this kind of came down to, you know, sort of this meeting in this small conference room in the basement of the Capitol where a couple of White House aides or soon-to-be White House aides met with the heads of the various congressional committees on the Democratic side. And they really gave just sort of bright lines as to, you know, here are some things that we're thinking about. Can each committee look at what projects can you guys get done quickly? And then also, you know, where do you think we can go with long-term investments? So a lot of this, the writing of the bill was left up to, you know, the architects of Congressman David Obie of Wisconsin, who was the head of the Appropriations Committee, and then the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. And what you saw happen was that every, you know, the head of every congressional committee set out a wish list of things that they thought could help, but also things that had been on their wish list for years, sometimes decades. And so rather than focusing on a few small programs that people, economists thought could have for the best bang for the buck, there was sort of a little bit of everything where the money was spread far and wide, but nobody could really do anything significant with it. And it was hard for the public to really understand what the stimulus was.
And to the issue of why Republicans, except a very, very few, did not participate in voting for this bill, I guess I have to ask the question. I can understand there would be a certain number of Republican ideologues who would just be opposed to this, going all the way back to their opposition to Keynesian economics and government spending as a way to get out of a recession. But then there are lots of Republican congressmen who go back home and like to bring things home, like to bring the bacon back to the people. Why was it so difficult to get some of these folks who understand the importance of the constituency mission in their jobs?
Well, there was a combination of different things, because obviously each senator is and congressman somewhat different. But it's important to remember that back in 2008, the Republicans had just been dealt this historic defeat, you know, one of the worst in decades. Democrats in 2006 and 2008 won, you know, by a landslide in Congress. And so they were on the defensive now. And there was a big push from Senator McConnell and John Boehner, the head Republican in the House, to keep the Republicans together as a block. And, you know, when you're on the defensive, all you can do is block, is kind of the idea. At the same time, though, there are still several moderates in Congress. At one point in time, there were 10 Republicans who were actively working with Democrats and having meetings and going over portions of the bill, trying to come to an agreement on a bipartisan bill. There was this era of bipartisanship after President Obama had won and promised, you know, to run a presidency post-partisanship. So there was some amicability on the part to try to work together. And I think the current partisan gridlock would have us forget that. But in some of these meetings, there was a lot of discomfort. You know, I spoke to Senator Mel Martinez, who was involved in these meetings and could have been the fourth senator who would have voted for the bill. There were only three who did. And he said, you know, he got very uncomfortable as the talks became not about the merits of the bill, but about what do you need specifically to vote for this bill? What can we give you? And sort of this political strategy of trying to essentially horse trade to get votes rather than looking at the package as a whole.
And that itself may be some kind of a major turning point in Congress, because let's face it, Congress has spent most of its life horse trading. That's how legislation passes in Congress historically. So it's somewhat interesting. Maybe it's the Tea Party movement, and you might want to comment on the role that the Tea Party movement played in this, because clearly they were putting pressure on people not to be engaging in these spending programs.
Well, now, this was before the Tea Party. You know, stimulus had, in many ways, was the impetus for the Tea Party. You know, we had this anger over the bailouts, but they had not quite formed yet. There was, you know, a lot of anger. But then with the stimulus bill, there was a blogger by the name of Liberty Bell in Seattle who started talking about organizing protests and coming out and trying to use the tactics of anti-war protesters in Seattle and the sort of the anti-G8 protests that she saw in Seattle in a way for Republicans. And so she kind of put out some of these first ideas and held what was then called a porculus protest.
Say that again, Michael, a porculus protest?
Yes. It was, so to make fun of the stimulus, they called it the porculus.
Okay.
And so her first blogging, you know, led to some more prominent conservatives picking up on this and starting to promote porculus rallies around the country. And within days of this, you know, this started happening. With days of this, Rick Santelli of CNBC goes on his rant about Obama's new plan for housing and calls it, you know, says we're going to have a Chicago Tea Party. So that kind of gave it the name. But there was already this organizing beginning over the anger about the stimulus.
You're listening to Michael Graybell, author of Money Well Spent, The Truth Behind the Trillion-Dollar Stimulus, the Biggest Economic Recovery Plan in History. Now, back to the design of the bill. The bill had in it a number of provisions that you claim in your book clearly made it more difficult to get these shovel-ready projects going as quickly as could be. And I'd like you to touch on a couple of them. And again, did the Obama White House have any say in issues like this? Did they understand that by throwing in historic preservation rules and Buy American, you're likely going to slow down the very recovery that Joe Biden was out there bragging was going to happen so quickly?
Right. So there's a couple different things here. The reality of an infrastructure project is that in order to get it approved, you have to first bid out the work so that everyone has a fair chance to bid on the project. Then you have to sign the contracts. And then you had to go back to the Federal Department of Transportation for your approval before you could proceed. For many folks, this was about a four-month process, if not longer. And so by the time all of this paperwork was done, and this is just normal how the construction industry works, you know, the construction season was over in many states, and they had to wait to 2010. Now, where this other red tape came in with Buy American, for example, wastewater treatment plants in many different industries use parts that are no longer made in the United States. So they had to get these waivers. So these Buy American waiver requests are still going on to get these projects going, still going on, you know, in 2012. Now, the other thing that we saw was weatherization. Weatherization is this program to make homes more energy efficient, things like putting more insulation in so your heating bills don't cost so much. And this has always been described as the low-hanging fruit of the clean energy movement, something that could get started pretty quickly without much training. The problem was that they wanted to apply this thing called Davis-Bacon, which is essentially prevailing wages, to ensure that, you know, people, you can't bring in cheaper labor from outside the area. You have to essentially pay what the rate is in that area. And this had never been applied to weatherization work before. And so as a result, it took almost a year for the Labor Department to come up with these analyses and figure out how much people were supposed to be paid in every county in the country. So a lot of states were ready to go with weatherization work and had their list of which homes would be fixed, but couldn't do it because they didn't want to have to pay this back pay or not know what the rules were. So that was an unnecessary delay that the administration and Congress put on weatherization work. The other thing that happened was this was a dramatic increase from what nonprofit groups and states were used to dealing with. So a lot of states have historic preservation rules, and in some, you know, working class districts, almost every house qualifies under these historic preservation rules, but they only have two staff members. For example, in Michigan, I think 90% of the homes in line for weatherization work needed historic preservation review, but the office that was responsible for this only had two employees handling this influx of applications.
By the way, I might point out that I did hear from one of our listeners who tells me that in Idaho, when it comes to the weatherization issue, we actually delivered on time in 2 years and exceeded the contract production goals, the money that was handed off to a group called the Community Action Partnership Association of Idaho. And that leads me to, if I could diverge for a moment from our discussion, you mentioned your Kansas example. You have some wonderful examples in the book. One of the questions is, how does Michael Graybell know all this? And the answer to that apparently is a lot of travel, going to various places. You hit any number of states. Tell us about the research and how you've managed to get all this information.
Yeah, the research is done with a lot of interviews and a lot of on-the-ground reporting and a lot of research and looking at government documents and records. I set out looking at dozens of different projects in 15 different states over the last few years. And I focused on three main cities. One was Elkhart, Indiana, which was the RV capital of the world, which saw its unemployment rate go up significantly. Another was Aiken, South Carolina, that saw an influx of stimulus money for nuclear cleanup work and a lot of jobs created. And the third was Fremont, California, which had a simultaneous thing of their big auto plant closed, laying off almost 5,000 people. And it was also home to, the now infamous Solyndra project to build a solar panel factory. In addition to sort of this traveling I've done, I interviewed hundreds of people, both in the White House and Congress and, the workers who expected to be helped by this. And then I spent a lot of months, tens of thousands of government documents reading through and looking at what the administration was claiming had happened, what the auditors were claiming had happened, and then looking at the individual project reports that contractors and recipients of the money were required to file with the federal government.
You're listening to Michael Graybell. He is the author of Money Well Spent, The Truth Behind the Trillion-Dollar Stimulus, The Biggest Economic Recovery Plan in History. A major aim of the Recovery Act was to save jobs. Was it successful?
It was in a lot of ways. Independent, nonpartisan economic forecasting firms have done these models, and almost uniformly they agree that about 2 to 2.5 million jobs were created by the stimulus at its peak. In terms of save jobs, they've looked at one of the areas that was most successful was in this thing called the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund, which was a fund that was each state got a certain amount of money to try to save teachers' jobs. And in the end, in early 2010, when this was hitting its peak, about 300,000 teacher and other education employee jobs were being supported by stimulus money.
Okay, I'll admit it. I was part of the Cash for Clunkers program, and that was part of this program. How did it work?
So Cash for Clunkers kind of started out from the Auto Recovery Task Force, the people who are working on the auto bailout of GM and Chrysler, and ultimately to extend it, they used some stimulus money. What it did was all of a sudden, you saw this sort of very little spending happening, very little, stimulus projects hadn't started yet, and then they come out with Cash for Clunkers, and all of a sudden there is this huge excitement on the part of consumers to buy things again. And it was sort of the first ray of hope in the economy where you could see that the consumer appetite was still there. All of a sudden, car dealerships are swamped with people buying and looking at cars, and their dealer lots are emptied out. And as a result, the auto plants went back to work, adding shifts, hiring workers back, and restarting production to sort of replace their inventory. So in a lot of ways, it created this sort of short-term bump that the economy needed at that time. In the long term, it mainly pulled these car sales forward that would have happened over the next couple of years, and it's received some criticism for that. But there is a benefit in pulling these car sales forward.
One of the most disappointing aspects of the book for me was your discussion of the mass transit issue. Here was this great opportunity that seemed by the end of the stimulus to be dashed by politics of Congress, by decisions made locally that didn't make a lot of sense. Help us understand, especially those two major projects in Florida and California, and what the hope was and what happened.
Right, and we're talking about high-speed rail. If you look at all the other major industrialized countries in the world, almost every one has a high-speed rail line or is in the planning to have a high-speed rail line other than the U.S. We are stuck, you know, with Amtrak, and so as a result, passenger rail has gotten a bad name. So here they were with $8 billion to invest in high-speed rail, more than they ever had had. And these various development groups have said the best rail line to build would be in the Northeast Corridor or, you know, I think they put out in California, San Francisco to L.A. And instead of spending money in the Northeast Corridor, it was largely shut out. And this money was spread around to 30 states to try to start up a high-speed rail system. And sort of this going notion is that, you know, since America is so used to Amtrak and sort of this really bad, not on time service, the public is not going to buy into a high speed rail line until they see one. And once they see one, they're going to love it and everyone's going to want one. So rather than pursuing this strategy, they spread the money far and wide, and no one was really able to build a high speed rail line. There was a lot of extensions of service that were proposed. You know, there were some governors in Wisconsin and Florida in Ohio, who rejected the money. So as a result, those plans were scuttled. And then out in California, where there were some hope in San Francisco to L.A., they decided to build the high-speed rail line out in the San Joaquin Valley on a rail line that the California High-Speed Rail Authority has said they will not run trains on until it connects to a major metropolitan area. So you have this great risk now of having the so-called train to nowhere if there isn't enough money to eventually build this line. So 5-10 years from now, we probably still will not have a high-speed rail line that the public can see and fall in love with and cause more excitement to build out the high-speed rail system.
This just fascinates me from the standpoint of the decision-making process. In the end, who made that decision or who didn't make it? I mean, you would think that the Secretary of Transportation would know exactly what you have to do here if you're going to make high-speed rail work. Were their recommendations just overridden by Congress, or was the problem within the Department of Transportation?
So this was not a decision by Congress. Congress just said $8 billion for high-speed rail. It was up to the Department of Transportation to decide which projects to do. But because it was a stimulus, one of the things they had to do was meet these arbitrary deadlines to qualify as quote-unquote stimulus. You know, you can't call it stimulus and then wait 10 years to start building. But high-speed rail is something that everyone acknowledges is going to take decades to achieve in this country. And to say that you've got to have a project ready to go in 2 or 3 years, I think was difficult to achieve. And that's what the Federal Department of Transportation was trying to work within. The other thing that happened was there was this idea of politics of trying to spread the money far and wide so that everybody got a bite at the apple and didn't feel left out. I had this great quote from Dan Carroll, who is, you know, in Oregon now, and he was sort of one of the founding members of this green jobs movement of promoting things like high-speed rail and clean energy. And he said, you know, when you hand out $100 million to the state of Oregon or the state of Washington to do high-speed rail and split up $8 billion instead of awarding it to two people to actually build a not arable word system, nobody goes anywhere. So everyone's short cash of the project they want to do. The feds split the baby because they think they're doing good politics, but in fact, it leaves everybody a little short.
I hesitate to ask the next question because I think anybody who wants a complete treatment of the stimulus program and whether it worked or whether it didn't has to read your entire book, and it's not easy to sum up in a paragraph or two whether it worked or it didn't. But you do conclude that the Recovery Act failed to live up to its promise, not necessarily because it was too small, but perhaps poorly designed. Do you think the Obama White House today looks back on it and wonders what they could have done, and what would you have done differently if you were putting this thing all together again?
I do think the administration has thought about this, and in conversations I've had with aides who have since left the White House, they, you know, are very reflective on what they could have done and couldn't done differently. One former White House advisor said to me, what we should have done was really have a limited package up front that could have been possibly bipartisan and would have had clear definable things for the administration to claim credit for. Cutting, here I am, the new president, I cut your taxes, I saved your teacher, I saved your cop, I created some construction jobs. Look at me, I'm the new president. How great did we do? At the same time, the administration could have been working on a larger investment package that didn't have to meet these short-term deadlines of saying we've got to get everything done in 6 months, even though these are long-term problems that we're dealing with in energy, education, and high-speed rail, and try to push through a second stimulus in the fall of 2009, when they had 60 Democrats in Senate, which is something they had not had since the 1970s. And this is a significant thing because 60 votes, defeats a filibuster. But the problem was the White House economic team could not come to an agreement on how to balance stimulus and deficit and propose such a plan.
Yours is the first and only comprehensive treatment of this stimulus package, and I wasn't around for the New Deal, but I've read that not all benefits from the New Deal were immediately clear, and of course the legacy of the New Deal kicked in over generations. I guess I have to ask whether or not you think there is anything still out there in the implementation stage of this stimulus program that when somebody else writes about this 5 or 10 years from now may be able to throw in a few more complimentary chapters on how this whole right. thing turned out.
So the legacy of the stimulus is going to be determined a lot by the politics in the next few years. Will some of these programs continue? If 30 years from now we're all driving around in electric cars, we will be looking back and saying, well, the stimulus is really where all that started. If we start having solar farms and wind farms around the country, I think we'll mostly be looking back and saying, well, the stimulus is where all of this started. In a situation now, with the stimulus having been designed the way it was and creating such animosity, some of these longer-term bills that would be needed to create these things, like a full high-speed rail system, seem to be so very unlikely. It seems like the partisan politics has become so stagnant that none of these extensions that need to happen are likely to take place in the next 5 to 10 years. So some of that is going to be wait and see. There is a chance for if these things do occur that we'll look back on the legacy and say, well, it all started with the stimulus package. But the politics right now kind of leave us on a sour note.
You do remind me, and I should have mentioned it, Michael, that you wrote a column recently since you wrote the book about the fact that the progress on the electric car can be attributed to the stimulus, I believe.
That's right. One of the things the administration can claim credit for is the revival of an electric car and battery industry in the U.S. There are now 30 factories that are being built around the country, many of them in the Rust Belt, which is kind of novel. The companies, by and large, have all told me if it wasn't for the stimulus package, we would be building these plants overseas or not at all. And so as a result, you have many electric car models and hybrid models being introduced in the next few years, and you have a battery industry in the U.S. that didn't exist before.
And with that, we'll leave it to our listeners to discover the rest of the stimulus package in the book, Money Well Spent, The Truth Behind the $1 trillion Stimulus, The Biggest Economic Recovery Plan in History, by Michael Graybell. Michael, thanks for joining us today on Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me.
Next week, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Deborah Blum, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.